Hello, and welcome to the Uncharted podcast, where we explore possibilities in higher education through uplifting conversations and inspiring ideas. I'm Tara Hargrove, one of your hosts for today, and with me is today's co-host, Lem Garcia. Hi, Lem.
Hi, Tara. How are you? Thanks for joining us here at Uncharted. Today, we're going to be talking with Jim Wibberding. He's professor and chair of the Department of Theology here at Pacific Union College. And we're going to be talking about his recently published book, Walking with the Pioneers, The Captivating Story of West Coast Adventism. Welcome to the Uncharted podcast, Jim.
Thank you, Lem. Thank you, Tara. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. I have to say, Jim, I'm not a big reader at all. It's not something I really enjoy, but you know how people say I couldn't put it down. In this case, I could put it down, and I put it down frequently to annoy my family with, did you know this? Did you know this?
Yeah. Well, that's fun.
So I couldn't sit quietly and read it. I had to share stories and tidbits. So I'm really excited to hear more about the process and the inspiration behind your book today.
It's a really, really cool book to read. Lots of things that I found relatable as well. It's like, I didn't know that. Being so close to where some of these things happened. But I have a fun question for you, Jim. So you've spent a lot of time with 19th century West Coast pioneers in your research. If you could take one of them out for coffee today, I don't know if you're a coffee drinker, but you know, coffee, matcha, whatever it is, who would it be? I'm dying to know.
Wow. So that's a tough question because there are so many exciting characters. And we're used to hearing the stories from New England and Battle Creek. And so many of the West Coast characters are less known. If I had to choose one, though, I think I would choose Jenny Ireland. Jenny Ireland was a kid growing up in those early days of the movement. Her family joined the movement in the 1870s. And that was just the very beginning. And then she got a front row seat to the development of the Pacific Press and the college and the hospital. She was kind of there as a kid for all of it. And then she joined the work and became a major leader, pioneered the work in the Black community in Southern California, and was just a major, visionary in the cause. But if we could also invite John Loughborough to join us. I would love to have his firsthand account of the earliest days.
Oh, like. Yeah. Yes. I was so excited when I was reading your book because Loughborough is one of my personal favorite like pioneers. And there's so many stories attached to it. So I'm sure we'll get into the nitty gritty of that. But that's such a good choice. I think I would probably want to join that conversation.
Yeah, you'd have to take us with you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
If we can ever arrange it, I'll do that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. So what first sparked the idea for this book? Was it a single story, a gap in history, or something else? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a long time in the making. When I was pastoring first in Pennsylvania. So I've pastored around the country and experienced the various flavors of Adventism, across the country at least. I got this idea that I wanted to understand the local story. So I did my best to look through archives and books and ask questions. And over time, more tools were available to me in the digital archives. And so I made that a practice. Every place that I've ministered, I dig into the archives and try to pull out the local story. And when I was beginning here at PUC to do that, I started to realize something that I hadn't really picked up on before, and that is that West Coast Adventism had a different DNA from the start. Okay, and so when I continued to study and explore, and that became clearer and clearer, I said to myself, "This is useful because it's helping me understand what I experienced growing up on the West Coast in Western Washington. And it's also, I think, helpful for us to ponder where we are in our Adventist movement today." Mm. So that was really the modus behind writing the book.
Wow. Okay.
Mm. And I noticed that as far as the period of history that you cover, it's roughly 1859 to 1909. And there's a lot happening there. How did you decide on that time frame specifically?
Yeah, that was a challenge. So you have to understand, this is a hobby for me. So when my kids are watching TV, I'm on my phone looking through the archives and I'm finding stuff, and it's exciting, and it's way more than you can ever share. So there's this question of, how do I tell, kind of skim the cream off the top here? How do I put the story in a form that people can digest and somebody who's a little less nerdy than me can really enjoy? And so part of that was thinking through what is most embryonic in this story. And, you know, 50 years is a nice sort of block. It gets us to the early days of the healthcare work in Southern California, as well as starting with Merritt Kellogg coming across the country and sharing the faith for the first time in a public way. So it was just that foundational piece. It was a nice block for representing that well.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's roughly 50 years. And in your book, without giving too many spoilers, but you talk about these three concepts of these three projects, right? For lack of a better word, that they set up to do in 50 years to be able to accomplish as much as they did. That's fascinating to me.
It is basically building from nothing to something more dynamic than anything else that was happening in the church at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really interesting to think about how much work they did in such a short amount of time. Yeah. Makes you feel bad sometimes for how much we're doing now. So for those unfamiliar, what was really unique about West Coast Adventism compared to the movement's beginnings elsewhere?
Yeah, so it's, as we kind of analyze that, there are some very clear differences, but there's nuance as well. So the early days of Adventism were wild. They were, you know, for lack of a better word, they were progressive in the sense that they were exploratory. You know, even the Millerite movement was charting new territory, you know, new ground. They were exploring new things. And as the post-disappointment Adventists began to sort out their biblical understanding, coming from all their different religious backgrounds, they were also charting new territory. But then you get to Battle Creek in the 1850s. 1855 is really the date where they start to settle into Battle Creek, and they begin to build an institutional center. And whenever we build institution, we put parameters, right? And so you think of the 1850s there, and you have people like Uriah Smith, who's moving towards formalizing some creedal statements, or at least statements of faith, in the early 1870s. And you think of what's going on in the West Coast, and you have a very different culture surrounding this Adventist movement. And you have Merritt Kellogg landing on the West Coast before we even named ourselves. So it's pretty early sort of DNA. And then John Loughborough, who's very anti-creedal, he's interested in not having authorities telling us what to do. He's the primary pioneer on the West Coast. And so all of that just resonates with a group of people that went west as far as they could until an ocean stopped them. Mm-hmm. And that's the population they're sharing with. So this very pioneering, creative sort of movement emerges. And it also is very inclusive because you have people from all walks of life, the rich and the poor, people from various ethnic backgrounds, various countries landing in the Bay Area, in part to search for gold. But now they have to do life together. And so there are fewer extra rules, if you will. Again, it's still very much the Adventist teachings, but there are fewer extra rules to keep people out, because the more rules we have, the more exclusive we become. And they just can't do that here. So it's a very free-thinking, inclusive, creative movement. And I suppose we could add some more adjectives to that, but hopefully that gives a general picture.
Yes, yes. And maybe there's an opportunity to go a little deeper, if you'd like, into some of these characters. Is there any one in particular where you can say this pioneer's journey really captures the grit and the faith of that era, of what it was like to be a pioneer in the West Coast?
Yeah. Once again, you're asking me hard questions because you're asking me to choose. There are so many fascinating stories here. But John Loughborough, who we've already mentioned, is, of course, key, because he is really the builder of Adventism on the West Coast. Other leaders come and go, but he stays for about half a century and builds it. But I actually am drawn to the story of his second wife, His first wife had died in Battle Creek during childbirth. And his second wife, Maggie. They married just before he came west to be an evangelist. And she came west to be an evangelist, too. Mm-hmm. She was very involved in the work. She was doing anointings, and there were miraculous healings. And she stayed at their first church plant in Petaluma, along with Marion Bordeaux. And the two of them pastored that church group for a good while, while their husbands went off and started other ones. And I think that illustrates some of the social structures that were broken down on the West Coast. And that really became a thing in the West Coast as well, that more women were in ministry, and there was a cultural acceptance of that. The Adventist pioneers had already begun to work out the theology of that, but this was the space where they could live out their theology and be more inclusive. So I love, even though she was only there for a while and she died of tuberculosis, I love her story because I think it captures that space to innovate, space to lead.
That's so cool. During my time at seminary, for one of the classes that I had to take, I was doing research at the Center for Adventist Research and going through unpublished letters and manuscripts. And I found a letter. There was correspondence between Ellen White and I think it was Maggie.
Oh, wow.
And in particular, there was something that Maggie was just sort of venting in regards to, and this comes up in your book, the struggle for not just their relationship, but other pioneers. I mean, today we can just jump on a plane and be in the East Coast, you know, in 4 hours. But back then, it's a whole journey, and it's months of separation, and I imagine that taking a toll on multiple families. And so,
for sure,
in this letter, Ellen White is encouraging her and just sort of like providing that pastoral, maternal friendship as well of just like, you know, being there for her. And I thought that was so heartwarming to see the very human side of that connection.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one little note on her, when she was in St. Helena dying of tuberculosis, she wrote a letter to John, who was out ministering around, saying, If you are not here when I die, don't feel bad for that. Just never leave the work of God. And of course, as a good husband, he hightailed at home and stayed by her bedside until she passed away. But you see that human struggle. You see that the dedication that comes through even in the time of struggle.
Yes, yes. And one thing that I also really appreciated about that section of your book was, and I'm so glad that you included this, the fact that there was some that caused some reflection and deep soul searching for John. And I identified that as self-awareness, you know, which is a term that we use now. But I was like, John, he's having a moment of self-awareness. And I'm like, that is probably also something we can attach to West Coast Adventism. The ability to look back, it's like self-critique and say, could I have done this better? Could there have been a better way that caused or had different impacts? I mean, the results of what they were doing were amazing, right? I mean, Maggie pastoring in Petaluma with Marion, like, I'm like, we had women leadership back then.
We did.
And yet there were moments where they could look back and it's like, ooh, I could have done this differently.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I too resonate with the human side of the pioneers. And in my research, I read their letters and I see some of the dynamics that you're naming. And for me, that's extraordinarily encouraging because I'm a human. You know, I have my struggles, I have my successes, but there's also the grind, there's the difficulty, there's this, you know, private matter that we're trying to, you know, sort out while we're also trying to do ministry. This has always been there. It's just part of the journey.
It's, it's so good to know that you're human, Jim. Mm. That's a great aspect of the book.
Were there questions about this?
You never know. You never know. Right. So You're kind of talking a little bit about this, but what were some of the biggest cultural or geographical challenges they faced? It seemed like they faced a lot. Things were very different there, and that was a really interesting aspect of the book. But what would you see as the biggest challenges they faced in those ways?
Yeah. One of the challenges, you know, every coin has two sides. One of the great aspects of West Coast Adventism and the context was the independent thinking that allowed for innovations that really shaped the Adventist movement in significant ways and continued to in the decades since then, actually.
Right.
If you think about some of the other innovations in subsequent decades beyond the end of the book, many of them came from here because of that cultural dynamic. But the independence also created some challenges. The Loughboroughs and the Bordeauxs were the first two official evangelist pairs who came out. The Bordeauxs didn't stay long. And you see this kind of jubilant report of the early days. Oh, this is wonderful. And then you read the letters in the next few months, and it's getting cold, and they're not enjoying this. Later on, when James White is involved in starting the Pacific Press, he has a lot of frustration with what he terms the California people. And it surrounds them not following his instructions and having their own ideas, right? And so you also have in 1877, they have to do something about music because people just don't sing together. They're so independent on the West Coast, they just don't harmonize, they don't sing well together. And so down,
it's interesting.
It's actually at Yountville, the Yountville crossroad there, when it hits the river, there's a camp meeting site. And in 1877, Edson White, the rebellious son of James and Ellen, and John Loughborough arranged to bring an organ from the Bay Area, loaned from an organ maker. You know, he wants to sell organs. And they put it on the stage. And the purpose here is to try to get the people to sing better because, again, they're so wild and disjointed. And so they decide that rhythm is going to help. And so, but they don't tell anybody it's an organ because pump organ would be scandalous in worship. And so all they know is there's this crate on the stage. It's a wooden crate. And everybody's asking, what's in the crate? What's in the crate? And finally, John Loughborough stands up and he reads Psalm 100, where it talks about all the instruments and music. And in the older translations, one of those is organ. And when he comes to it, he spells it out, O-R-G-A-N, and cracks open the crate and they introduce rhythm to music. Wow.
The drama of that.
Yes.
Yeah. And it scandalizes much of the Adventist world for a while. And then, of course, it becomes a mainstay. But all of that was really about trying to deal with this other side of the cultural dynamic that was so exciting and innovating. It also meant that they didn't work well together sometimes or sing well together.
Interesting. When I asked that question, I did not think you would talk about singing together as one of the challenges. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. That is fascinating. And it sounds like they were willing to be risk takers.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a prime example of that. Any other examples that you can think of where they were, you know, willing to kind of push things a little bit or go beyond the norm?
Are you trying to get me in trouble here?
Not at all.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
No, some of the stories I hesitate to tell because I know there are implications that I might not want to communicate. But one of the surprises for me was the involvement with early Adventists in the wine industry here in Napa Valley. And I'm not endorsing, I'm not encouraging anybody to start drinking wine, but it was just a much more open sort of posture to a lot of things, including that, than you might get in Battle Creek, for example. So you have John Mavity. He was a major mover in establishing all three of the big structures, the publishing, the healthcare, education. He was a founding member of the St. Helena Seventh-day Adventist Church, and he was also president of the local Wine Growers Association. So you have that. I also found an interesting report in the newspaper of Merritt Kellogg, down in Pope Valley at Etna Springs, and he was at a dance.
Oh, whoa.
Now, the newspaper said everyone danced till midnight and went home with the girl. He was married, so that might have been okay. but just the fact that he was willing to be seen at this community event like that was significant. There was involvement in politics. Merrick Kellogg himself became a justice of the peace. He was a representative for a political party as well to a convention. And this was not necessarily typical. It did happen elsewhere, but it was more prominent here.
I'm glad you highlighted that because we sometimes miss those details in the sense of we think of Adventist gatherings as being the tent meetings, the camp meetings, the itinerant preaching and whatnot. But a lot of these converts that were well off and influential figures within their communities already were connected all, to so many people in so many ways. And so they were using their influence. And it reminds me of a book I read where it was showing the statistics. When you break down the Gospels and the Book of Acts, statistically, most of the miracles in those books occur in what people and missiologists call the marketplace, which is not stores, but where life happens. The business of life is happening. And so it sounds like these pioneers were very much in alignment with that because, again, they were already connected to all these different organizations and groups and vendors or whatnot. And from there is where they were able to exert influence and make more connections and all of those things then ended up in purchasing land or property or pitching ideas. And so I think that's a reminder, an invitation for us that it's okay to be connected.
Yes.
Because so much blessing can come from that.
Yes, yes, agreed. And just one more note on that. When they formed our college over in Healdsburg, one of the very intentional postures they took was to collaborate with the community about the shape that the college would take. And it was definitely about our mission, but it was also about serving that community in the ways that made sense in that context. And this created some conflict later with others in the denomination, but that posture is beautiful. And it made a difference. It made it successful.
Yeah, I really loved that aspect, reading about the beginning and how they really did talk with the community and considered that in what they were doing. That was really fascinating to me. And yes. I don't know if you want to talk about it, but Ellen G. White's kind of perspective and just getting to know her a little bit in this book in a different way was really fascinating to me. I don't know if you want to speak to that at all.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said there, I think. For those like me who grew up in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Ellen White was a regressive voice. People would quote her to me, and she was trying to pull us back from whatever the culture was doing right now. In her time, she was definitely on the other side of that. She was the progressive voice. She was the innovator. And one tell is the fact that she spent 35 to 40 years of her life with a residence here in California, okay? She was drawn to that West Coast innovative mindset, and she would often work much faster than the General Conference was willing. So late in the book, I talk about the formation of Loma Linda University Medical School, and it was a College of Medical Evangelists early on. And the General Conference didn't want to do it, and so Ellen did. Okay. They had a new no debt policy, and they were worried about the cost of trying to build up a medical empire in Southern California. There wasn't much population in Southern California. They weren't even sure it was a good idea. But Ellen went around looking for money in her own bank account, as well as asking others. And she put it together and bought some facilities that had been built during the boom. And then the population had receded. And so she could get them really cheap comparatively. And then the population came back. She was pretty, she had some foresight there. And she built up this medical empire, which is just amazing. Imagine if we didn't have Loma Linda University Medical School, right? If it was up to the GC committee, who was trying to manage funds appropriately, so
right.
I get it.
Right.
We wouldn't. And the year that she died, they also tried to close it down because it was costing too much. So
wow.
1915, she's hardly cold. And they convened in Loma Linda, California, tried to close it down. And one of her proteges, Hetty Hurd Haskell, a dynamic leader in her own right, got together with three other women who were also significant influencers, and they crashed the meeting. As they're getting ready to take the vote to close Loma Linda University Medical School, or College of Medical Evangelists at the time, they knock on the door, and they come in with a plan to scale up instead of scaling back, and they save the school. But that's Ellen White's influence. These were Ellen White's people. So she was the innovator, no doubt.
Yeah, I love that. I think that was my favorite part of this book, was just getting to know her in that way and understanding her in a completely different way than I grew up understanding her. So that was super fascinating to me.
It was fascinating. And if I can go in a little deeper too, like, to me, it reminded me of the fivefold gift as we see it in Ephesians, you know, the apostolic gift, prophetic gift, evangelistic gift, teachers and shepherds. And often when we think of Ellen White, we're reminded of the prophetic gift, right? Obviously. But as I kept reading your book, it's like, oh, I see the apostolic gift in her and the rest as well. In having vision, in thinking, in, you know, taking those risks and going and doing stuff that was not being done before. How do we recover some of that? Because it seems like we currently only focus on shepherding, teaching, maybe evangelist, and we say, like, we've already checked the mark off prophetic gift with Ellen White in the past, but it's a fivefold manifestation. And so, like, do we just operate under two, three? Like, I'd love to hear a little bit of your thoughts on that.
Wow, that's a big question. I think it's worth pondering much more than we can in these few moments. But I think I appreciate that you just pointed to scripture and that there is this dynamic, there is this calling. Okay. And so a big part of it for me is simply giving permission, right? There are those who are called to innovate, to chart a new course. Yes, there are those who are called to kind of anchor us and keep us in a safe territory, but there are those who are called to be the expanding edge of the movement. And a big part of it is simply giving permission, legitimizing that, validating that, going back to scripture and saying, hey, it's here, it's our call. And also, this is a big part of why I feel compelled to share the West Coast Adventist story, is because I also believe it gives that permission. We feel the calling, but there's often kind of a counterweight or a headwind or whatever metaphor fits here that says, no, you got to be more cautious than that. But West Coast Adventism has always been at its best when we have been the creative edge of the mission. And so giving that permission for those who are already feeling the call to do some creative stuff that serves the mission, serves our Adventist heritage, is biblically guided. All of those things are crucially important. But instead of thinking in terms of conservative or liberal, I think it's more a question of, are we willing to follow scripture and the Spirit where it's going to lead us, right? And that might lead us to some things that are traditional, and it might lead us to some things that are new. It's a third way in my thinking.
Mm. And I think your book is such a great way to engage that conversation and give permission and retell these stories of how we got here, right? And the possibilities are endless moving forward.
Yeah. So that dream that you dreamed up at 2 a.m. when you couldn't sleep, that may not be crazy. We have a precedent. We have justification. It may be that God's calling us to do something new and exciting to expand the mission.
Is that kind of what you want the modern church to learn from this?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
Very much so. History is never really about the past. It's always about the present and the future, and also the stories that we tell define us. So it's important to tell a broader story. These things are true as well.
Yes. And I think I kept reading, and this term came up in your book of, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was Western no, or California liberality, or what was it?
Can we even say that?
Can we even say that? But it wasn't used in the sense of what would, you know, the thoughts that would come to our mind today. It was a little bit different. And can you maybe speak to that? And maybe how does that connect to the mission of the church, you know, as we move forward? And what are some of the things that we can glean from that, at least in our context? Because after all, we are in California and we are PUC and we have deep roots here in the stories that you are sharing with us in your book. So are there any parallels that can help us to, that can propel us forward?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And there's, it's not just the culture of the past. We know that the West Coast is still the place where culture shifts first, where changes tend to happen first. So we still have that context, and we are called to this context. So how do we interact with it? That's the big question. Rather than just defaulting to some structures that may have been handed to us, how do we interact with the opportunities that are here? Okay, so maybe there are some dangers. Let's be aware of those. There are also opportunities, right? So yeah, going back to the California liberality, that actually came from Ellen White, interestingly enough.
Wow.
John Loughborough was heading out here, and Ellen White knew that he was reserved in some ways, that especially he was penny pinching. He wouldn't spend money. And so she wrote a letter, knowing that gold was in the economy here, that change was in the air. She wrote him a letter and said, you need to adapt to the California liberality. Mm. And the most pointed message at the moment was, go ahead and spend money. But he took it to be much more, as kind of a picture of flexibility. You need to adapt. You need to go with the opportunity that's before you. And so that really did shape his approach, and I think brought a lot of success. A later term that I like came with the conflict between the East and the West at the college, between William Granger, who was president, and William Warren Prescott, who was General Conference Education Secretary. And Prescott was offended at that Western informality. He ousted Granger and almost killed the school. So they had to bring it back. So the combination of California liberality, Western informality, those are good terms to kind of encapsulate that more free-flowing opportunity. But I'm not sure I answered your question. You had a more pointed question.
No, I like where you're going with that, because one thing that popped into my mind as I was reading that was, did the variety, the diversity of California, even at that time, the different opportunities, just the excitement, contribute to that mindset? Whereas in more homogenous, you know, more different context where you don't see a lot of variety in thinking and opportunity, it tends to box you in. It just made me think, like, does our context contribute, you know, somehow to not just the opportunities, but the way we think?
Very much so. And a great illustration of this is actually women in leadership, because early on, the Adventist pioneers were pushed by the presence of Ellen White and other ministers to develop a very biblical understanding of ministry and affirming of women in leadership. But their cultural context often didn't create the space they felt like they needed to fully implement that. Women were in leadership, but they often weren't ordained, those kinds of things. On the West Coast, we had this cultural dynamic of the pioneer woman, where as you have a couple come from, say, New Jersey, and they're moving west, the crisis of the frontier lands requires that everybody has to do everything. Women do the men's work, and the men do the women's work, and it created a culture on the West Coast where some of those kind of traditional expectations were broken down. And so we see this explosion of women in pastoral ministry in particular coming out of Hillsburg, where that's not happening in Battle Creek. There are some leaders that are women coming from Battle Creek for sure, but there's this explosion of evangelists and missionaries and pastors of local congregations coming from the West Coast. And even the way that the 1881 resolution at the General Conference to ordain women was reported was different. In Battle Creek, it was reported as having gone to committee. In Oakland, the Signs of the Times reported it as adopted. And I think that had something to do with the local culture, what was acceptable, what they would expect. It was just, so that's a great illustration of the idea you're talking about, just the way that they related to gender in those early days.
That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing those stories. What was the most rewarding and the most challenging part of researching and writing? You've already alluded to having to narrow some things down, but any other things that you encounter along the way in this process?
The most rewarding for me was probably self-understanding. To realize that Adventist DNA, not core Adventist beliefs, but the DNA that surrounds those beliefs, was different from the start. I was a West Coast kid. I grew up in Western Washington, and then I went to Southern and studied there. I was a Bible worker in on Sand Mountain, Alabama, okay, the Deep South. And then I pastored in Pennsylvania, which is very traditional place. Of course, went to school in Michigan, pastored in Boise, Idaho, then back in Washington. And in some of those places, as much as I think I settled in and contributed, I felt out of place. And to be validated in this freer thinking way, you know, I'm very Adventist. I believe in our core theology, but I just felt different. I didn't want to wear a tie to church, you know, this kind of Western informality stuff. Yeah. I felt validated. So that was one of the big takeaways personally. And I think for others, what drove me to write the book was to also validate that for others. Not everybody grew up on the West Coast. Not everyone resonates with it, but many, many do. And to understand this is also part of our story, that's a big takeaway for me. I was just with a group of pastors in Upper Columbia Conference sharing some of these stories over the last few days. And the most frequent conversation was, wow, I feel validated, or some form of that. So that's gratifying.
I bet that is. Yeah. I didn't grow up Adventist. And I grew up in Colorado. So I guess I have that Western spirit a little bit.
You do. Wilds of Colorado.
Yes.
That explains a lot, Tara.
Does it? Should have told you before. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the book, because I found that really interesting that you had stories and then you had kind of this tour aspect at the end. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that was really cool to kind of really be able to visualize where things happened in that way. So talk about that.
Yeah. As far as the origin of that, I had been working on some kind of tour stops just to take students to, or interested parties that I could talk into it. So I'd been kind of working on that. And I had also been telling a few of these West Coast Adventist stories. And I got an email from Dale Galusha at the Pacific Press asking, are you open to writing a book on West Coast Adventist places? And so initially it was the tour guide. That was the primary kind of focus. And as time went on, I realized, really, I just want to tell the story. Right. So it kind of morphed into a combination of the two. But why do the places matter? For me, and I think for a lot of other people, it makes it more real. You walk in the space, you see the trim on the house that Merritt Kellogg made himself and put there. And you think about his story and the textures of his life, as well as the big moments, but just the textures of his life, it makes him more real to me. And it also gives a space in which to reflect on the stories. So yes, the book has a lot of specific locations, addresses, some of which you should just drive by and not knock on the door, and some of which are public places. But the purpose there is to, well, it's called Walking with the Pioneers, to journey with them and kind of immerse yourself in the textures of their world as you seek to understand their story.
Yeah, I really liked that, because I need to have reading, like I said, is not something that I enjoy usually. I need that visual, and I was able to really picture the things that had happened then and made history come alive a lot more for me. And so I liked that aspect. What do you think, Len?
That was fun because having grown up in the Bay Area, I mean, there's a lot of places that I know. So like reading through the book, Oakland, I'm like, oh, that's so close. You know, like I've driven through there, or like, why did I know that this was moved? And same here with, you know, Yountville. And I love how you're very specific with the instructions. And so anyone who reads this book, whether they have, you know, visited California, the Bay Area or not, I think will be able to get that sense of connection to the stories that you are presenting. And so I really appreciate that.
Well, very cool. Very cool. I hope that people locally who are listening to the podcast just take the book on a Sabbath afternoon and go explore, because much of the first 50 years of the movement happened right in our neighborhood. So these places are pretty local for many people.
I definitely found myself wanting to do that. Okay. Telling my husband, now we need to drive around here and here and here. And yeah, that would be very interesting to actually see all this.
That would be fun. Have you done any tours following the book itself recently? Or because I could kind of envision this happening and, you know, taking shape into something really cool and fascinating.
So I have for my classes, and Laura, who teaches in the, my wife, who teaches in the history department, has also done tours of the cemetery, you know, telling stories by the graveside. And we've gone over to Healdsburg and some of those sites. And I've taken people on personal tours. But as far as something bigger, we are in conversation with the NAD and also Matthew Lucio, who does the Adventist History podcast, about doing a bus tour of West Coast Adventist history. So I'm hoping that we develop it into more. But as far as whether the, you know, I followed the book, it's more the other direction. The book follows some of the tours that we've developed here and there.
Yeah. Oh. Bus tours can be really fun. Again, from my time in seminary, one of the classes that they offered, it's, you can either you do the normal class in coursework a summer, but you can also take the tour option and drive through New England. And so that kind of reminded me, like, this could be something like that, and it would be really fun.
Yes, watch for that. I think we are stirring with ideas. So watch for that, because I think something will be announced in the, within the next several months or the next year or two.
Nice, nice. Yeah. I'm excited. I'll have to sign up for that for sure.
Yeah.
So if someone reads Walking with the Pioneers, what's the one thing you hope they take away?
Go wild in the mission. Let God lead you. That's what I think I see happening most prominently in the story. Is that the people were willing to follow the call of Scripture and the Spirit of God to carry forward the mission in ways that honored God. And I would love to see us willing to overcome our fears and the naysayers and simply follow God in the mission.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yes, yes. Yes, we've been able to read and get copies of your book, but what can our listeners, where can they get copies of your book?
They can go online right now and make an impulse purchase.
Do it right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Probably the best way is just to go online. It's in all major outlets. You can get it for, you can get it in printed form, or you can get it digitally as well. And it's of course less expensive in digital form, but either way.
Nice. And will you be doing a... Audible copy where you voice
that's a good question. Yeah. I've indicated to the publisher that I'm willing to do that. Okay. I'm willing to record that, and they sent it to a committee that studies that, so we'll see.
Okay.
We'll make an announcement if something develops.
We'll look
there.
Out for that. So I have a copy here, Jim, with us in the studio, and I would love if you would sign my copy, because I think that's so cool to have books signed by the authors. Would Absolutely. You do us, do me the honor?
I would do that. Yes.
Thank you.
Might even write you a nice note.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do have a copy as well. And Jim was gracious enough to write something in there for me as well. So thank you. I appreciate that, Jim.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, As we wrap up our conversation, one thing that is coming into my mind, Tara, Jim, is also this idea that a lot of these pioneers, even though we have maybe their photos from when they were older, but they engaged the work when they were young adults or even younger than that. And we live in a context where we have the privilege to journey, to mentor, to teach young adults and equip them and empower them to engage in mission, but also to live their dream for their purpose, live out their purpose, their God-given purpose. And so that's something that stays with me. I'm wondering if there's anything that, you know, you take away from our conversation and from the book.
Wow, there's so much from this book. Like I said, I just kept sharing so much with my family and just the spirit of the pioneers. It was just so cool to hear their stories and to know how much work they did in such a short amount of time for God. And yeah, I just want to, in some small way, be a part of that here.
Any last thoughts, Jim?
I've shared a lot, and I may be a little bit repetitive, but what I do hope for is that those who would read the book and ponder it would be inspired with the mission and the possibilities. Too often for me, even as a full-time pastor and now as a full-time professor, there are aspects of what we do that just become routine. And it's about the mission, yes, because we're contributing to, I don't know, the machine that we've created. But I hope that those who read the story, who think about it, who perhaps take those walks through the spaces that the pioneers walked through, I hope that people will be inspired to pursue the calling that God places on their hearts and feel like they've been given permission by our heritage to do so. I just don't think God is done with us. I don't think that God built this church and all the structures and institutions that surround it and just expected them to kind of continue as they were. There's more. There's a world to win. There are people out there who desperately need Jesus, and we need to be creative in our space to share Jesus with the world. I hope those who read it will feel both inspired and permitted to do so.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, thank you so much, Jim, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So good, so good. If today's conversation gave you a new perspective, sparked a question, or stirred something worth sitting with, subscribe to the podcast so you can keep exploring with us. We're here to uplift, encourage, and remind you that you're not alone in this journey. And if you're on Instagram, follow us at @uncharted_PUC for uplifting campus stories, fresh perspectives, and a little inspiration for the road ahead. Until next time, explore boldly, care deeply, and lead bravely.